Well, the NFL owners meetings wrapped up in Phoenix this week, and Ira, you and I went to a zillion of them. We didn't go this year, but other than the free breakfasts, what do you miss most?
I miss the Monday night party because I am known as the king of schmooze, Mr. Judge. And the media, somehow they invite the media. I mean, one of these years, they're going to cut out the media. But as long as they have it, you know, it's a pool party for 3 hours, great food, but more importantly, great access.
Great access. That's right. You get guys that you wouldn't otherwise get. And you can get tipped off the stories.
And if it's off the record, that's fine. That's fine. It gives you entree and it makes it a lot easier to talk to these guys on the record at a later date when they know who you are.
Yeah, they point you in the right direction, honestly. I agree with you on that. Going to this week, what story were you most interested in other than Scotty Miller leaving the Bucks?
You know, I'm going to tell you something, Clark. In the old days, and I don't mean that far back, but, you know, people like the Rooneys, the Maras, they built this league, Clark, and they built this league on one foundation. What's best for the league?
That's right.
And now those guys are dying out, and then John Mara comes out of a meeting yesterday about the Thursday flex thing and says, this is crazy. Forget about health concerns. You know, it's all about your partners and maximizing your profit.
Yep.
And, Clark, this is nuts. This is nuts. How much money does this league want to make?
Well, apparently not enough. They don't have enough, and they want to make more. But I don't know what that figure is. I agree with you. I'm going to visit that a little bit later, Ira. Last question here. What happens first? Aaron Rodgers to the Jets? Lamar Jackson getting a new deal? Or Tom Brady unretiring?
I think Lamar Jackson. I think the Rodgers thing, I think we're 3 months away. And that means get up, morning, and here comes Stephen A. Smith. And everybody weighing it. It's great fodder for these guys. Clark, they've been talking about Aaron Rodgers ever since the final game was played, the Super Bowl ended.
I think the Aaron Rodgers deal gets done before the draft. It has to me.
Yeah. So we shall see. Look, I think it's a done deal. I think he's going to Jets. I don't think he's got a lot of options at this point.
I think he has no options. I think the Jets have no options. Ian, do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Jets need this to happen. The Packers have already moved on, so...
Okay, guys, on to another question and not involved with this week's owners meetings. When former Kansas City wide receiver Otis Taylor passed away at the age of 80 early this month, there was an outpouring of grief and sympathy, as you know, for someone football fans. And I'm not talking about just Chiefs fans believe should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but he's not. In fact, Ira, you know this. He's never been a finalist. So the question is, does he belong? Does he belong in Canton? And to answer it, we've asked best-selling author, journalist, and passionate Kansas City Chiefs fan, Michael McCambridge, to join us. And lucky for us, he said yes. Michael, thanks for being here. I know you're busy. You're getting ready to push another book in October, which is called, I think, the Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America, correct?
Yes, sir. Guilty. Well, keeping me up nights. Good to be with you, gentlemen, today.
You kept us up nights because we both read that book, but... you're on with Ira and Clark, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here. And
Mike, I got a little book right here, and I believe one of these guys holding up Hank Stram happens to be Otis Taylor, Michael. Now, I think you got to KC in 71, which was a very good year for the Chiefs. I guess you were 8 years old or whatever. But, Mike, I followed you closely, and you are an authority on that franchise. Mike, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Don't ask why, but my brother gravitated toward the Raiders, the silver and black in the 60s in the AFL. Sibling rivalry. I took the opposite team, the arch rivals, so I became a Chiefs fan, Mike. Late 60s, it never got any better than Chiefs Raiders. Late 60s, early 70s.
One of the great rivalries in pro football history. Yep.
Yeah, Mike, in particular. Mike, 410 catches, 57 touchdowns. You know, the numbers don't jump out for Otis Taylor, number 89. But, Mike, the name of the show is the Eye Test for Two. It's very Hall of Fame-centric, and we always talk about guys like Hines Ward. If you saw him play, you know, you know what kind of player he was. Mike, does Otis Taylor pass the eye test?
I think Otis Taylor is Exhibit A in the eye test. Otis Taylor, you know, we take a look at modern wide receivers. And what do we want? We want tall, strong, elusive. He was that in the mid-60s. And I think that one of the best recommendations for Otis Taylor came from the great scout and GM Don Klosterman, who said the first time he saw Jerry Rice, the person he was reminded of was Otis Taylor. And I think the case for Otis being in the Hall of Fame starts with he changed the game. He was the future of what that position looked like before almost anybody else got there. And he marshaled a set of skills that had not been seen. That wasn't stuff that Raymond Berry was doing. And, you know, there were obviously great receivers before the 60s, but Otis was, as people like to say today, one of one. And I think that the numbers that you mentioned, Ira, as much as I respect the Hall of Fame voters, I think it is very difficult from a perspective of the 2020s to try to put offensive football in the 1960s and 70s in perspective. And so you kind of have to compare Taylor to his contemporaries and look at his impact. And, you know, that 1971 season, he was the UPI Offensive Player of the Year that year. And think of that era, what a wide receiver would have to do to be named Offensive Player of the Year. It was extraordinary. So I think the case does involve the eye test, and it involves talking to the cornerbacks who had to cover him and the teammates who played with him.
Mike, along that line, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was just going to ask you, talk about the respect Otis Taylor generated among his peers, guys like Willie Brown, Mike, even Herb Adderley, you know, faced him in Super Bowl I. And, you know, Otis Taylor made some catches in Super Bowl I while it was still a game. What was the respect around the league for Otis Taylor?
He was what the coaches call a difference maker. He was guys that you had to rotate your zone, the double team. He was one of those guys that when the defensive coordinator started the game plan, it started with Otis Taylor. You know, Hank Stram, and I think justifiably so, has a reputation as an offensive innovator. But if you go back and look at the numbers, that was a very run-heavy team in Kansas City. There were lots of bells and whistles. There was the tight eye formation. There was all sorts of makeup in Hank Stram's Wild West variety show, but they didn't really pass the ball that much, nowhere near as much as, say, the Cowboys did. And in my mind, as I've been watching this over the decades, I think there was going to be one wide receiver from that era whose numbers didn't quite fit with what people think a Hall of Fame receiver should have, and it wound up being Bob Hayes. And Bob Hayes was a terrific receiver, but I don't think competitively he had the impact that Otis Taylor had. And if I can go off on a filibuster here for a short minute, sure. I think you would be hard pressed to find any wide receiver who had more decisive plays in one postseason than Otis Taylor did in that 1969 season, the Chiefs' first Super Bowl. In windswept Shea Stadium in that divisional playoff game against the Jets, Taylor drew up a play in the dirt the beginning of the fourth quarter after the Chiefs made a great goal line stand and held the Jets to a field goal. And he caught a 61-yard pass that broke that game open. It was tied 6-6 at that time. 2 weeks later in the AFL championship game, he caught double covered, a great pass from the end zone from Len Dawson right up against the sidelines. That was the key play in the Chiefs go ahead drive against the Raiders. And as everyone who's watched NFL films knows, he made the game-breaking play in Super Bowl IV after the Vikings had opened the second half with a touchdown drive. Dawson found Taylor on a quick hitch, and he eluded Ursel McBee and took it up to the house from 46 yards. That killed that game. He was the key player in the 1969 postseason.
We're speaking with author and historian Michael McCambridge on the Eye Test for Two, and we're talking about the Kansas City Chiefs in general and Otis Taylor in particular. And Michael, talk about Otis and that 69 team. There were a lot of great players on that team. I mean, I think when you look at it, I think it's as many as 10, including Hank Stram and owner Lamar Hunt, so at least 8 players. But there's some people who are missing. Otis Taylor's one. Ed Buddy's another. Jim Tyra is another. Of that group, who would be the first one you would admit to Canton?
Boy, it's a tough question, because one of the things that you run up against is, hey, all these Chiefs players are already in there, right, and they only won one Super Bowl. Now, that team was, as you well know, in the history of the AFL, was the only team to win 3 AFL titles. But you run into that. I would put Taylor in, because much respect to Jim Tyra, much respect to Ed Buddy, who in 1968, one week when the Chiefs were out of receivers, Ed Buddy won AFL Player of the Week, which a lineman never does. But I would say Taylor in, because I think Taylor changed the game more. Tyra was an excellent offensive tackle, but it's not like the history of the game was changed because of his presence. Same thing with Ed Buddy, who was very durable and very reliable. But Otis was the future writ large. So I would say Taylor was the one who belongs.
Speaking of that team, Michael wrote a book about that club, and it was released in 2019. It's called The 69 Chiefs, The Team, A Season, and The Birth of Modern Kansas City. Now, we're talking about offensive personnel, but the thing that struck me about that team was their defense. They led the league in rush defense, pass defense, total yards, and they held 3 playoff opponents to a total of 20 points. They have 6 Hall of Famers from that one unit. And if you look at everything they did that year, it compares favorably to the best of all time. And yet, Michael, when we talk about the best of all time, the 69 Chiefs don't really get their due. You hear about, I think, the 76 Steelers were as good as I've seen. You go to the 85 Bears, 2000 Ravens. Yep. Ira's pushing the 2002 Bucks. Why don't the Chiefs get more recognition on that side of the ball? And should they get more recognition?
Well, I think the reason why is it was year one BC. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that think pro football started in 1970 with the complete merger. And so they just don't get enough. They don't get enough credit. I think the second reason is something that Dwight White of the Steelers has pointed out. He said there's 2 kinds of Super Bowl teams that nobody remembers. Team that loses the Super Bowl and teams that only win one. And it's true. You know, we think of the Packers, we think of the Dolphins, we think of the Steelers, et cetera, going through. And that Chiefs team only won one Super Bowl. And you can go back to Christmas Day, 1971, that double overtime, generation changing game against the Miami Dolphins. The Chiefs win that game. They would have been favored the next week. And Hank Stram would have been in 3 of the first 6 Super Bowls. He would have gotten into the Hall of Fame a lot sooner. That was Otis Taylor's best year. I think he would be in the Hall of Fame today if the Chiefs had won that game. So, yeah, I think they should be. And you take a look at that postseason again, holding the defending world champion Jets to 6 points at Shea Stadium, holding the Raiders, who had the most explosive offense in pro football that year, to 7 points, despite a bunch of turnovers on the offensive side, and then shutting down the Vikings to 7 points. It was a legitimately great defense.
But you know, it's funny, Michael, when talking about that team, and Ira and Ian know this, when I was at a 2012 playoff game between the Ravens and the Denver Broncos, went to double overtime. And so afterwards, we're in the press room waiting for Joe Flacco to come out. And then some of these TV people and reporters were saying, is this the longest game ever? Has there ever been a game longer than this? And I said, yeah, the Ed Podolak game. And they looked at me as if I were speaking Cantonese. I mean, like they cocked their heads. Said, Ed Podolak, Chiefs, Dolphins. They had no idea. Had no idea. So they had forgotten.
Yep, it's true. I don't think they'd forgotten. I think they never knew.
Probably.
Mike, I want to take you back to that 70 AFL championship game. Mike, the last game ever played in the American Football League.
Yep.
Mike, the Raiders, you know, had already beaten the Chiefs twice. They won the division. They were a powerhouse, you know, with Biletnikoff and LaMonica and everything. And, Mike, go back to that play, because I think it's the biggest play in Chiefs history. I do. I believe it was 3rd and 14 from the 2-yard line. The game was tied, Mike. I think it was the 3rd quarter, maybe. Mike, if they don't complete that pass, they're probably going to lose that game.
John Madden, who I interviewed for America's Game, my sort of modern history of the NFL, insisted if they don't complete that pass, the Raiders win the game. And then that Chiefs team never wins a Super Bowl. And he said, you know, he made the point that the Chiefs tended to be innovative when they were ahead and had everything going for them, but they could tighten up a little bit in close games. So it was a brave call by either Dawson or Stram. Dawson, who was not the most elusive quarterback in the pocket, but was very accurate, did a good job of eluding the rush.
And the protection was very good on that play, Mike. The protection was solid. Yeah, it was solid.
But he had to wait a while for Taylor to get down the field, and then Taylor caught that ball in double coverage, and it was a remarkable tightrope walk down the sideline. It was a play that I have to admit might have been reviewed in the modern era of instant replay, but whether he got all of 2 feet down or not, it was a remarkable freaking catch against double coverage and given the situation, to your point.
I think Willie Brown was one of the guys in the vicinity, if I'm mistaken, Mike.
Yeah.
Mike, here's another part of the Otis Taylor story, and you tell me where it fits in, but I think it's indicative of the character of Otis Taylor. Mike, I'll take you to next year, 1970. You know this play well. The Ben Davidson play, the spear play. 2 minutes left. The Chiefs have a 3-point lead. Dawson bootlegs, and Dawson was not known for his mobility, Mike. But the Raiders fell for it. It was supposed to be, you know, a fake sweep to the left, and here comes Dawson. He's got the first down. The game's over. Mike, the game's over. He tumbles to the ground. Davidson spears him in the back. Mike, the guy that comes flying in and wrestles Davidson to the ground is number 89, Otis Taylor. Ultimately, Mike, Blanda kicks a field goal. It was a big result for the Chiefs. Instead of a win, they get a tie. Mike, what would that say about Otis Taylor?
Otis was a team player, and he was somebody who would go to the well for you. He was one of those guys who he would die on that hill. A year later, in the rematch at Municipal Stadium, Chiefs are behind by a point late in the game. Dawson hits Taylor well short of the first down. And Taylor fights off three Raider tacklers to get the extra 5 yards to the first down. He was a gamer and he was a battler. And that melee, that I was, it's 1970. I was 7 years old at that time. And the Raiders Chiefs fight, which because the game was blacked out, I only heard on the radio, just sounded like World War III or something from the perspective of a 7 year old true believer. It was amazing, and it still lives in the lore. I think that is the moment that best typifies the Chiefs-Raiders rivalry.
We're speaking with Arthur and Cambridge on the eye test for two. And Michael, I just want to ask you about that. You're talking about that rivalry. What do you think was the better rivalry, the Chiefs and the Raiders or the Raiders and the Steelers? Because you're writing a book about the 70s too.
The Raiders and the Steelers was epic because they were almost always fighting each other in January in the playoffs. Chiefs and Raiders was one of those things where it was like Ravens Steelers in the modern age, where they're playing each other twice a year. They know each other so well. They are the dearest of enemies, if you will. So I think historically speaking, certainly the Raiders-Steelers rivalry of the 70s was one of the defining rivalries in the history of pro football. And it was a little bit different with the Chiefs and the Raiders because they were dealing with each other in the same division and rarely faced each other in the playoffs. Although, to your point, they did 2 years in a row, 68 and 69.
Yeah. And then earlier you'd mentioned a book that you'd written, America's Game, which was a bestseller and highly acclaimed. America's Game, the epic story of how pro football captured a nation. I think it was released in 2004. Remember getting it. We've got a copy here at home. Full disclosure, Ira, my wife is mentioned on page 460 in the acknowledgments. I'm not going to mention her name. It also is a book that historian Chris Willis, who I'm fairly close to at NFL Films, called The Top Pro Football Book of All Time. So it got highly acclaimed. So Michael, after that introduction, let me ask you, as a historian and someone who knows history of this game as well as anyone, and certainly the history of the Chiefs, Are you bothered by what I would call recency bias, especially with all-time lists? And I ask that because every time I see something, and I'm going to go to your team, the Kansas City Chiefs. Every time I see Patrick Mahomes do something, it's the greatest thing we've ever seen. I've never seen a pass like that. And I saw a pass on Twitter where he threw one, I think it was against the Ravens a couple years ago, rolled right, throws left, and it was about 56 yards downfield. Somebody puts it on Twitter, says, we've never seen that pass before. I went, I have. I saw John Elway do it in Stanford. I saw John Elway do it with the Broncos. Then there was another pass, like behind the back or under the arm or blindfold or whatever. And they said, we've never seen anything like this. Someone posted last week, and I mentioned this to these guys, Archie Manning with the Houston Oilers. You've probably seen this where he recovers a fumble behind the line of scrimmage run, and then he throws a shovel pass about 15 yards down the field. It's caught by Mike Renfro, and he goes for like 20 more yards. And so there seems to be sort of a just a block against anything that happened, you know, before 5 minutes ago. I find that frustrating. Do you, as an historian?
I think of myself when I was growing up. I wasn't aware of what Otto Graham did with the Browns. You know, I didn't really appreciate the Lions and the way they sort of were innovators in the 2-minute offense with Bobby Lane. So I sort of see it as part of the process of growing up and getting a sense of historical perspective and institutional memory. I can remember, I think it was last year, and ESPN does good work, don't get me wrong, but last year, the pregame before a TCU game, and I don't know, I think it was like TCU and somebody else who was undefeated, 7-0, and in the pregame show, the announcer said, this is the biggest game in TCU's history. And I was like, somebody better tell Dan Jenkins that, because he wrote about their national championship back in the 30s. So,
right.
You know, it's just, I think it's one of those things that is annoying. And as we get older, it gets annoyinger.
That's right. That's right. And ours and I are not getting older. We're just getting more experience. That's what we say.
Yeah. We're aging into Mike, that demographic.
There you go.
I got one more for you, Mike. Thanks so much for your time, Mike. It's been a pleasure. Mike, this is something that I've been saying, you know, for a long time as somebody who follows the Chiefs closely. Mike, let's go back to that double overtime. It you know, unbelievable, 50 years later, still the longest game in NFL history. Mike, they're winning the whole game. They keep getting ahead. The Dolphins keep tying them. And, of course, Stenerud misses a chip shot field goal. Mike, I've been saying that in the history of football, I can't think of a more consequential loss to a franchise than that game was to the Chiefs. Now, Mike, I'm not willing to say that the 71 team was better than 69. I don't think that's true necessarily. A lot of people
believe that. Len Dawson did, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the offense was better, but the defense was not nearly as good in 71. Mike, am I wrong about the consequences the last game in Municipal Stadium? There's a lot of factors that went on. They were never the same, Mike, never.
It was the total end of an era. And if you got time for one more quick story, the most consequential play in that game was a fake field goal that the Chiefs had called. They'd seen the Dolphins overloading one side on their field goal block unit. And the Chiefs had a play. Bobby Bell was going to snap the ball directly to Jan Stenerud, and the guards were going to pull, and he was going to be wide open for a touchdown. And they called the fake, and Bobby Bell looking back between his legs at Len Dawson and Stenerud, and these are three Hall of Famers we're talking about here, looks at them, and they are playing their parts so well, he's not sure that they made the call. So he snaps the ball to Dawson instead of Stenerud. Dawson doesn't know what to do. Stenerud is shocked. He's getting ready to run. Dawson says, just try to kick it. By then it was too late. That would have put the Chiefs up 14 points, I think, and the Dolphins wouldn't have come back. So, yes, it was an end of an era. The Chiefs went to one playoff game in the next 15 seasons, and the franchise was not revived until Carl Peterson and Marty Schottenheimer got there in 89. Yeah, it was huge. It was the end of the innocence for a young Chiefs.
Thank you, Don Henley. Ira, as you well know, don't ask Jan Stenerud about those misses.
Oh, yeah. And a great Hall of Fame career that is unfairly but somewhat understandably defined by by that one game. Jan made countless number of great kicks, but yeah, that's what people remember.
Yeah. A couple last ones for me, Michael. And this one's a little bit tough for you, but you're an historian, so I'm going to put you on the spot. Whom do you consider the greatest quarterback of all time?
Well, it's hard to argue with all of Tom Brady's Super Bowl rings. The one distinction I would make between Brady and anybody else is for the first, you know, 5-10 years of Brady's career, nobody was saying he was the best quarterback in football.
Right.
That came later as he matured and New England was such a powerhouse and, you know, still one of the greatest comebacks, if not the greatest comeback in football history, is down 28-3 to the Falcons, and he just won't go away. So terrific gamer. But in terms of a talented quarterback who carries his team, I think Patrick Mahomes has to be considered just based thus far. And obviously it's still a short career among the greatest and most talented quarterbacks ever. And then time will tell how many rings there are. But, you know, Montana, by the time they were winning their second or third Super Bowl, he was considered the best quarterback in football. And you couldn't say that for Brady's first few Super Bowls. So I think time will tell.
Okay, I'm just going to throw you a little curveball here. On the cover of your book, America's Game, there's my greatest quarterback that I grew up watching. That'd be John Unitas. And I remember saying to my dad, "Have you ever seen anyone like Unitas?" He goes, "Yeah, Otto Graham."
Right. Look at
Otto Graham's record.
Otto Graham still.
10 championship games,
yeah.
7 championship titles. You can't beat that.
And that's what the resume that Mahomes is building, 5 AFC championship games in a row. It is, you know, it's a more competitive environment these days,
right,
especially in that conference with all those stud quarterbacks. It's remarkable.
Last question for you. It has nothing to do with football, okay?
Hit me.
All right, I don't know if you know this, but when Michael first started, he was hired in 1988 by the Austin American-Statesman as a music critic. So you know where I'm going, Ira. Michael, as a music critic, why did it take Todd Rundgren so long to get to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Platinum albums, man. You know what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is about. It's statistics, just like the Pro Football Hall of Fame is about. And there's not enough time and attention paid to the people who were innovators, just as with Otis Taylor and some others. Dave Parker in the Baseball Hall of Fame. That's a hill I know some people will die on as well. So, yeah.
I'll just leave you with this. Todd is God, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Michael McCambridge, thanks so much for the time. Great listening to you. And we'll look forward to your book in October, The Big Time, How the 1970s Transformed Sports in America. Michael, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Same here. Take care, Mike, guys. Have a great day.
That was author Michael McCambridge. And Ira, 69 Chiefs defense. Where do you put it in history? I mean, that was a great defense.
Great question, Clark. It's up there. It's up there with the 85 Bears. It's up there with the 2000 Ravens, 02 Bucks. You're right. Maybe the 13 Seahawks. I mean, you know, there's been some great defense. Clark, I will say this. They've got 6 people on that defense with gold jackets.
Oh, no question. Hey, yeah, loaded. Loaded.
Clark, you weren't somewhere, but somebody was doing something.
Yeah, they're starting the engine.
Something wrong.
They're starting the engines. You know, they're starting the engine. You know where that's going? It's going to Indianapolis. Those are the trucks moving out of Owings Mill, Maryland, 40 years ago, Ira. 40 years ago. That was the anniversary of this Tuesday. It was March 28th, 1984. And that sound tells you all that you need to know. The middle of the night was snowing that night. I lived in Baltimore, actually downtown Baltimore. They brought the trucks in because earlier that day, the state legislature had permitted the city of Baltimore to wrest control of the Colts from Robert Irsay, who was the owner. He decided, not going to let them do it. Brought in the trucks in. Adios. They're down the road in the middle of the night. And I'll never forget the day after, maybe a couple days after I was on the Evening Sun, call Burt Jones, see what he says. Call Burt Jones, see what he says. And never forget what he said. Well, look at it two ways. One is there's an upside to this. Oh, actually, he said the downside first. The one is there's a downside to this. You lost a great franchise. I mean, Robert Irsay ripped the soul out of that city when he took the Colts. But he said, look at the upside. you get rid of Robert Irsay, goes to Indianapolis. So sort of bittersweet, but you know what? You get rid of a bad owner. And he was right. And Ira, here's the thing that's hard for me to understand and believe. But the Colts have now been in Indianapolis. It'll be 40 years this season, longer than they were in Baltimore. They were in Baltimore for 34.
Clark, I want to ask you this. You've been to all the stadiums, the atmosphere around football games, everywhere. Clark, what was it like mid-60s, late-60s, early-70s, Johnny Unitas Memorial Stadium? What was that atmosphere like in Baltimore?
Remember what they called it? The world's loudest outdoor insane asylum. I mean, that's what it was. It was just crazy. Orrsville, you know, with Lenny Moore catch a pass, that game was against the Lions when they actually lost in the last seconds, but Moore makes a great catch in the end zone in the dying seconds. They mob him because they've gone ahead, and they just forgot to cover Jim Gibbons on the last play. Tight end goes 80 yards, whatever it was, 75. But the fans were crazy. When they left, it ripped the spirit and the soul and the heart out of that city. And I don't know, Ira, that it's ever recovered, because they took everything with them, not just the belongings. They took the history, the uniforms, everything. They took that. And, I mean, I look at what the Browns did, and I thought, Art Modell actually did Cleveland a favor. Keep the name, keep the history. That's all gone. I mean, I think it wasn't that long ago. Well, maybe it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It didn't seem that long ago. Somebody, might have been Raymond Berry, asked the Colts, could you return at least the history of the team? And no, we're not letting go of that. So it really made it very sad for people in there and for lifelong Colts fans. And I grew up as a lifelong Colts fan.
Clark, one more quick question. A buddy of mine, and I haven't told you this, but he's in the middle of a book on Tom Matty. He's writing a book about Tom Matty. Yeah. You know, and about some of these famous historical games that Matty played. What's Matty's legacy in Baltimore, Clark?
Great running back, but a versatile and important and really good running back and a pretty decent backup quarterback. To me, what he did in that, well, I think it was at 65 championship game against Green Bay was remarkable. I mean, he has the plays taped to his wrist, and they run and run and run. They should have beaten the Packers, and they really did. But Chandler missed the field goal at the end, but they called it good. But in any case, he was beloved there because I think then they go into – remember they had a runner-up bowl? I think it was Dallas they played. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. I think they played Dallas. He was great as a quarterback. He was great. Tom Matty could do anything. He was great. And so he was beloved, and unfortunately, he's gone. But Tom Matty, I've got his picture on the wall here. He signed something for me when I was a kid. Never forgotten it. Anyway, Ira, final thoughts.
Final thoughts, my friend, is this man, McCambridge. And I've read four of his books, Clark. Now he's working on another one with the football in the sack. Can't wait for it. Clark, he's a great writer, very easy style to read. And boy, does he do his research. He's got my total respect. Michael Bridge. He's a jewel.
He's a great guest too. I love listening to him. I opened this with asking you about the owners' meetings. I want to finish by this. The NFL this week, they decided to allow teams to play two games each on Thursday night. I thought this was a team that was concerned about player safety. And they're talking about flexing games, you know, and I thought this was a league that was concerned about the fans. I thought this is the league that had the best ever officiating. Officiating has never been better. What are we looking at here, Ira? We don't care about the fans. We don't care about the players. What are we looking at?
Clark, the phrase that comes to my mind all the time, quote, our broadcast partners. Unquote.
That's correct.
They fuel the league, Clark. Let's not pretend it's the turnstile. It's the networks. And every 4 years, they up the ante. And whatever it takes to please these guys, and Amazon's not happy with the Thursday schedule, let's flex. You know, Clark, there's got to be an end to this. At some point, somebody's got to say, enough's enough.
Yeah, no, that's right. But as long as the salary cap keeps going up and the revenue keeps going up, that's enough. Apparently not enough. You talk about broadcast partner. I want to talk quickly about a journalistic partner. That's Jerry Green, who's the former Detroit news columnist. Passed away this week, or actually it was last weekend, I think, the age of 94. You knew him. I knew him. Great, great guy. He covered all 56 of the Super Bowls, the first 56 of them. Didn't cover this last one because he was in bad shape at home, but decided to write from home about it. He was in a assisted living facility. But Jerry was just a wonderful writer, voted Michigan Sports Writer of the Year 10 times. He's in the Hall of Fame of the McCann/Nunn Award. He's in the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. You know, Ira, like Michael McCambridge, a great writer, but Jerry was a better person.
He was. He's a titan, Clark. And of course, best friends with a friend of our show, Mike O'Hara. I'm sure those guys were very close over the years in Detroit. Every time I saw Jerry Green, Clark, he was never in a bad mood.
Never in a bad mood.
Never.
Yeah, and you know what he said? He was going to go to his grave as the last sports writer who covered championship games by the Lions, by the Tigers, by the Red Wings, and by the Pistons. And he did. He did. He's the only one. Anyway, that's going to do it. If you'd like to listen to this or any iTestFor2 podcast, you can. Just go to the iTestFor2.com. You'll find us there. Or you go to fullpresscoverage.com. That's Ian's place. Ian, if you listen here, get those engines started by the trucks because we're leaving, all right? Get those engines started. Otherwise, you can find us right here next week at the iTestFor2. Trucks are leaving. Iris, are we? Thanks so much for listening.